This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith, here with Kathy Sheppas.
Hey, everyone.
And our guest in the studio is Lisa Morales Hellebo. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce it in the languages of those two names, who is the co-founder of Refashioned Ventures and the Worldwide Supply Chain Federation. Hi, Lisa.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I first heard your name, I think, because you did a startup that was doing something with selling products on Instagram before Instagram turned that on, right?
Oh, God, no. So it seems like many moons ago, I had built Shopsy, which I actually ended up licensing the URL to a company that did the Instagram thing after we shut down.
Oh, okay.
So my company was like if Polyvore was algorithmically generating outfits on the fly from over 6,000 brands. It was the concept was there's these meaningful groups of disparate items that someone put into an intentional context, and yet they were static. I said, well, the future of search obviously is shopping things in context specific to you and your preferences. When are they going to make that algorithmically searchable and search by groups? And then they never did. And I said, well, somebody's got to do it. So that's what I built.
So it was kind of a search engine of sorts.
Yeah, it's contextual search. My thesis was that everything we purchase, we consume, gets used in a context, yet we shop it devoid of context or with somebody else's imposed context that isn't specific to you. And so everything, starting with outfits, dress, bags, shoes, into accessories, we would then go to undergarments. What kind of undergarments do you have to wear with an Hervé Léger bandage dress? It's very different than a baby doll. And then cosmetics groups. So if you can see that also applied to pretty much anything, your decor for your home, things that you need for your office, et cetera.
It seems like most websites are still not doing anything like that.
Yes.
They really don't connect those dots. So what happened to the technology?
Yeah, so I still own it.
Okay.
I went through Techstars and raised some venture capital, but I realized I learned a ton going through an accelerator like that. I went there specifically looking for champions at big fashion brands because I didn't have that network at the time. I knew tech cold. I just didn't have the fashion industry side. So they didn't either. They didn't have those contacts at the time.
Well, so then you started your own.
Yes. So I realized not only did they not have the contacts, but VCs really didn't care to admit what they didn't understand. And so rather than telling me that I built something they didn't understand, they'd say, well, sweetheart, why don't you buy some inventory like that nasty gal? And I'd look at them like, why are they letting you cut checks if you can't tell the difference between a traditional e-commerce brand you're valuing as if it has some proprietary IP and what I've built, which is the future of search. Is it just because they're both displaying fashion on the interface? Oh, I get it. So I realized that after we ended up failing, I didn't take on millions of dollars because I knew it needed to be a B2B product to scale. My concept was eventually pop-up shops that we could merchandise and sell to the brands, and they could be remixed by the consumer to make it their own. And it was an addictive experience. We had users spending 10 minutes to half an hour. Some of our super users would spend hours every night just remixing looks because it was fun. It's play. And it really got to the notion of discovery online. We have yet to really replicate that. We've got three types of shoppers that I've been tracking throughout my career. There's the hunter. The Amazon, I search, I know what I want, I get in, get out. The gatherer, who will pin stuff and share it on social to get feedback from friends and do a lot of, you know, comparison shopping to get the best price and discount. That's your gatherer. Needs a lot of inputs before they can pull the trigger. But the discoverer, now that's the most valuable shopper. In brick and mortar, that is your impulse buyer. And that person is 70 to 75% of all in-store purchases. So what I was looking to do was to tap into that, the impulse of, oh, I see it in the context that's meaningful to me. Now I totally love it and I get it and I need to buy it. The irrational shopper.
So this is the opposite of you bought a blue shirt. We're going to sell you a green shirt now.
Right. Exactly.
This is going from that to, okay, you bought a blue shirt. Now we're going to sell you pants that match the shirt.
Yes.
And underwear and socks and exactly. the whole thing and the rest of your wardrobe.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. There are some companies that are starting to get to that. I mean, I was way ahead of the industry, perhaps because I worked out in Silicon Valley during the first dot-com boom and bust for a Procter & Gamble and Redpoint Ventures-backed startup that was kind of a Skunk Works project out of P&G. And we became renowned, world renowned, for mass customization, personalization, and micromanufacturing of cosmetic, skincare, hair care, and fine fragrance back in 99. So I was just a gal playing with some user experience and algorithms and big data sets and having the time of my life with beauty. And I realized that set me up for exactly where I'm at today in my career. Everything happens for a reason. I just happened to be this weird girl that's been obsessed with fashion her whole life, went to Carnegie Mellon, worked in Silicon Valley, and became a super tech nerd architecting taxonomies and big data systems, and eventually building my own system that the VCs didn't understand, and I didn't want to raise millions of dollars and feeling obliged to sell my IP to someone that was going to turn it into a static look of the week site. So we shut down. And literally the day after we shut down, I got a call from ASOS, head of global innovation, saying, "What happened? We've been following you. You made something we need we've never seen before." Yeah, I'm sitting
there.
Where
were you yesterday?
We're fully dissolved. All my team has jobs elsewhere. Wow. You want the IP? And they were like, "Oh my God, if you were a widget or a plugin, we would totally buy you, but we don't want to hire teams of data scientists for an unproven technology and build out a whole department." So it was going nowhere. So I still own the IP is the long and short of it. And nobody has replicated anything quite similar to it, which was interesting because I had VCs telling me Google's going to knock this off in a heartbeat. I met with Google Ventures and they were like, "We need to understand your algorithms." I'm like, "No, you don't. Not unless you're putting in some money."
Right. And this was something that was kind of promised when Amazon was very new, like mid-90s.
Yeah.
They were saying, "Okay, if you buy this book or this movie, we're going to tell you other movies and books you might like based on other people who have profiles like you, based on like 10 products that you bought and 7 products that they bought." And they're going to. And they never invested in having the machines do the thinking.
Yes.
But when I hear of those algorithms, that makes me, that comment you made is still sitting in my head that 75% of purchases made online are irrational. Mm-hmm. Like it will take, seems like it will take us a long time to kind of get back to accepting that. Is that just the industry in general that? That statistic coming?
So brick and mortar is 70 to 75% of in-store purchases are impulse. And this is primarily a female thing. We enjoy shopping. It's a pastime. It's fun. It's visual. You don't know what you're looking for, but when you see it, you got to have it. And we do the magical math to amortize costs of how many outfits you can make with an expensive bag or whatever in our heads to be like, yeah, it's totally worth it. So it's something, the psychology of shopping has been a big part of my career as well, because it's been a big part of my life since I was a little girl. I grew up not being able to afford designer clothes because we were Puerto Rican family that moved from the Bronx to Westchester, and I literally have a Von Trapp moment of me wearing the curtains where my mom would sew everything for all of us. So being obsessed with fashion definitely had its payoff in that I had this unique obsession and perspective because of my choices throughout my studies and career.
So you started the New York Fashion Tech Lab.
Mm-hmm.
Which you've since departed and
yep.
That's running on its own.
Yeah.
What was it like to start that? How did you pull all the pieces together? Because, I mean, that was something that should have existed for a long time and just didn't.
Yeah. Right? So after Shopsy shut down, I was having dinner with Amy Millman from Springboard in the city here. And she said, "So what next?" I said, "For the first time in my life, I have no freaking clue." And she said, "Well, what if, you know, money was no object? What if you didn't have to worry about an income?" And I said, "Well, in that case, I would love to build the fashion tech accelerator I wish had existed when I went through Techstars." and it would be focused on really getting buy-in from the C-suite executives and champions within these huge companies to actually hand select the technologies that they thought were most meaningful to their bottom line, rather than what VCs think that is flippable within a couple of years, which is a vast difference in focus. And then really having them dedicated to chaperoning them throughout the program to give them access to anything they needed internal to get to a yes for a pilot, a paying customer, partnership, collaboration, whatever, because that was far more valuable than just raising capital. So from that first dinner, Amy said, you know, I'll get Kay Koplovitz on board. If she's on board, then she'll bring the first couple of brands to the table. That was 2013 in the summer. Right before Christmas, we met with three brands, Coach, Kate Spade, and J. Crew, COOs and CIO. And two of them said yes. And so January 1st, Amy calls me and said, okay, Lisa, go. And I had from January 1st until I think it was April 3rd or 4th when I turned on the website, opened applications to do all the legal, the branding, the website, the close 10 brands, get them to pay for it, to dedicate their C-suite executives' time and commit throughout this program to coordinate calendars, which was the most insane part in that timeline. And being able to get inbound so that we had applicants. We didn't have budget to promote it for weeks in advance. And we literally turned on the switch and had 2 weeks to get applicants with no prior promotion. So I knew I needed to have the brands to put on the website to attract. So when we launched, as soon as I turned on the website, I was inbound with like Fast Company, Women's Wear Daily saying, how did this happen? It happened overnight. I'm like, no, it took a little over 3 months of 16-hour days, but there it is. So we had more applicants than Springboard had in the prior 15 years of them having programs, and more media coverage, and we raised more money in a short period of time. So they were really excited about the success of the program. I realized throughout the cohort that an accelerator was kind of putting lipstick on the pig for this space. And I realized that because of the access I had to the C-suite executives and because of my background and expertise, area of focus, being a nerd, I was putting things together that most people didn't have knowledge of. And that was, even the big brands and retailers were focusing on all the wrong things. And they're not incentivized to focus on the right things. And so I said, okay, if the C-suite is only focused on the shiny objects that will get them their bonus, because it's like, ooh, we put a magic mirror into the store. Great. What's that doing to your bottom line? Is it drastically changing your margins or your supply chain in any way? No. So I left after the first cohort and said, I need to understand the supply chain because that's the biggest opportunity. You can't have an agile front end that everyone's investing in with a static back end. And that set me on my path for supply chain.
So this is a very deep rabbit hole. you started out, I think, with the New York supply chain meetup.
Yes.
Before you had a company, before you had the nonprofit.
Yeah.
You just started doing this to learn about it? Is that what that was?
No. So right after the Fashion Tech Lab, I spent about a year in maker labs, cut and sew shops, ateliers, couturiers, factories of all different sizes, learning the apparel supply chain and the current paradigm. I was like, I need to just dig in and be a student for a bit. And it was amazing. I tied it back to what I was doing in Silicon Valley for P&G and said, well, if we were doing that, micromanufacturing, mass customization, and personalization product one-offs back then, what's possible today for fashion? And what are the technologies that'll be driving this new paradigm? And so I put together a thesis like a good design thinking student, which was my degree, and visualized my findings and created a deck, you know, because I need to look at visuals to communicate clearly. And I started circulating that deck with certain people that I knew and trusted in the industry to get their feedback. I didn't want to look like an idiot if I was way off base on where the supply chain was going, but I knew that I needed to validate my findings in some way or disprove them. And so one of the first people I approached was a private equity fund who said they were investing in the future of the apparel supply chain. Hundreds of millions of dollars they're deploying. I meet with them and they said, yeah, we're putting new light bulbs and solar into the factories in India. That's our sustainability push. I was scratching my head like, why? Who is asking you to do this? That's insane. I hope you're not putting a lot of money in that, because that's not, yes, that's nice, but it's not the future.
Again, lipstick on a pig.
Yes, exactly. So they said, well, it's the brands that are asking us to do this. And that's when I thought to myself, do you understand your job? Again, VCs, why are you waiting for an industry to tell you what the future is going to be when they don't know? You should really be the thought leader if you're taking their capital to invest to help them evolve. And that's when I realized, after that and talking to Lian Feng and Deb Weinswig and all my other colleagues, they said, yeah, nobody else has arrived at the solution that you have. And it's valid. And so the concept was simple, I thought, that localization is the best possible catalyst we have to get to sustainability, circularity, and transparency via small batch, quick turn, and eventually on demand. And it would look like basically the concept of a distributed collaborative network like blockchain. And it would be a physical one, distributed collaborative microfactories connected via a shared data layer with real-time throughput capacity, load bearing, and intelligence, so that you could fill all the dead time on any factory's floor, but they're all sharing volume. And then volume becomes your raw materials for a region instead of your finished goods. And that took a long time to find out what the mental barriers were for the industry to comprehend. They said, yeah, that's definitely the future, but how? And to me, I was thinking, well, it's simple. You just use something like Evernew and have your raw materials be everyone's trash. Within a 600-mile radius, you have everything you need to produce everything you consume and then recycle it. So why is nobody focused on this?
You and I have been beating our heads against the same wall for several years on this same problem.
Uh-huh.
This is local is sustainable.
Yes.
This is where we should be, like, now.
Produce what's needed,
yes.
Not volume. And everyone's first pushback was, what does volume look like? And that's when I had to learn, well, it's your raw materials.
Yeah.
You have all... And you have to start with constraints. Everyone in the industry is beholden to creative. Creative is king. We come up with whatever our brand vision is for the season, and then we source and we scour the planet and, you know, sustainability be damned. We need that vision. And I said, no, that's interesting, but no. The future, if you're really committed to sustainability, it has to start with the constraints. And it's like an episode of Project Runway. Designers, this week you're working with Evernew's New Cycle, circularly regenerated textiles. You can produce athleisure, t-shirts, all kinds of stuff that can be done small batch, cut and sew, made in the USA. So it's really learning to teach the brands this new set of constraints and what's possible if they were to work within them. It's taken me since 2015 to find one champion brand that gets it, is all in, and I've been working with them towards getting to close an SOW, hopefully, knock on wood, within the next month or so, where we're going to be building out a pilot to show everyone, so everyone can stop talking
SOW?
About it. Oh, statement of work.
Okay.
So is that brand... mostly, that's an apparel brand.
Mm-hmm.
And are they mostly producing outside of the U.S. right now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you're talking, now I'm not in your world, right? So my questions
She's
are...
pointing at me.
Huh? Right. Well, because I'm thinking...
She should be pointing at both of us.
As you're talking, yeah, I'm not in your world. So as you are talking about localization, are you only focusing right now on localization within the U.S.?
Yes.
Okay. So not... Okay, that's one question.
Specifically within the New York metro area.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Our objective is to be able to say that it was designed in New York, produced in New York, sold in New York, and to track the exact carbon footprint, chemical usage, and water usage, because we now have a closed regionalized network where we can put in IoT trackers to actually have receipts on measuring all the things that everyone's saying, oh, we're going to be carbon neutral, whatever that means.
And this is where you use a blockchain.
Yeah.
Everybody exactly. else is trying to put blockchains on everything. Yes. This is where you actually use one.
Exactly. Yep.
And so, you feel that there is enough here already to be working with. I mean, I know there's a lot. I just sometimes don't think there's nearly enough in terms of manufacturing.
It's interesting. When you just focus on one thing, like this is my calling. It's what I was put on this planet to do. I'm certain of that because everything has started conspiring to help me get to where I need to go. And I've just been connecting to the right people that can help me fill the voids of whatever I need. But it's just a process like anything else. It's design thinking. It all comes back to my degree. I'm just a design thinker that wanted to solve all sides of the equation rather than what most brands are trying to do, hiring McKinsey or whoever to say, build us a localization solution. It needs to be cheap and blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's great, but it's probably going to be building you the past. And it's not going to solve, I guarantee you, for the overstock, dead stock, the consumer's addiction to fast fashion. We've been trying to unaddict them for 36 years. We've moved a centimeter in this 1,000-mile journey. It's not possible.
Well, so do you think that by using this sort of system, we could actually make fast fashion more sustainable, significantly more sustainable?
Significantly more sustainable than globalized fashion. It's not about fast or slow. It's about global or local. Because localization enables you to have a closed network of true transparency and have auditable real-time data throughputs with IoT in a way that you just can't in a globalized supply chain. It's impossible with the opacity and number of tiers of vendors.
So are you thinking of if you get a jacket back, you rip the zipper out and then you put it into another jacket? Or to what degree are we able to recycle these things?
Yeah, so we're starting really, really simple. What is the most ubiquitous thing that Americans wear and throw out like crazy? Any guesses?
Socks?
T-shirts?
T-shirts.
Okay.
Anything t-shirts, athleisure. That is American clothes with a lowercase c. Not fashion with a capital F, but clothes. And that is a big enough dent in the 4 times textile waste that we produce than the rest of the world that no longer is taking our textile waste. So if we can just start there and make athleisure, t-shirts, all that comfy clothes.
Tackling the creatures of Walmart.
Yeah, actually circular and enable, okay, you want a trend? We've got a way to customize a cool new cut on this t-shirt and have it, you know, the Serena Williams collection, whoever, and make it a trend that then can get traded in. Now many brands are starting to do that. Trade in your old, we'll give you a discount to the new. But this will give you a discount to actually, it's the raw materials you're giving back to us to create new fiber.
And there are actually a few companies that are doing that now.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
So what I realized is that brands would rather just come to me and say, well, will you do this for us? Instead of, I really was hoping that I would just be able to be the champion and show them the plan. Oops. Show them the plan and have them buy in, and they've got the money and the resources and the people. But no, it was just, you know, we trust the way you're thinking. We think that you have a unique perspective, and we recognize that for this to work, it can't be under a single brand. It has to be under a neutral, trusted third party, refashioned.
So how would this be, in your mind, how will this, would this be able to scale to be able to take on, you know, from mid-sized companies onto much larger volume companies?
We're definitely not going to be eliminating volume. It's a different type of product, and it's a different type of use case than fashion with a capital F and I could go into many rabbit holes about the bifurcation of the apparel supply chain beyond localization, artisanal supply chains, and so on and so forth. But I think that once you get the infrastructure in place, the infrastructure is what needs to become a shared asset. And I don't think, being a founder, I think it's crazy that the industry has been putting it on startups and these small companies to invest in their future.
Well, okay, so the industry in New York can't even share Fashion Week. They can't agree to be in the same building.
Exactly.
So how are they going to agree to be on the same infrastructure?
Yeah, so I realize that the only way to kind of get them to get over themselves is to say, you know, you're all talking a good game with, you know, the Copenhagen Fashion Summit, all the G7 thing, and all these pacts that you keep on changing every 5 years because you haven't even hit 1% of your goals. It's all great lip service. But when we actually do the thing and show them it's possible, shame on you if you are not leaning in. And so we knew we needed to find the right first brand that was collaborative, inherently collaborative, that we knew liked to already play with others, and that truly bought into the vision. It took me probably a year and a half of working with the C-suite of this brand to share with them my vision, to get them to buy in, to get them to kind of pull it out of me. Well, we just want you to do it. And for me to go, I'm building a fund and I have this global community and a 2-day global supply chain summit. And sure, you want something done, you ask a busy person and a mom.
So there are a lot of paradigm shifts that have to happen, but yep. Also a lot of paradigm shifts within organizations.
Yep.
Right. And how they collaborate. So what do you think are some of the biggest challenges in terms of bringing the creative side of the organization together with the supply chain
yep.
side to work with you to make this happen?
Yeah.
Because both are so important. And right now, I might almost say the creative are further along on the road of wanting sustainability.
Yeah.
At times.
It's interesting. They do, but they are still hesitant because they're like, wait, I need to work with constraints. I'm creative. But when I frame it as like Project Runway, that's when the designers start to go, oh, yeah, it is possible. They do it every week on Project Runway. So I think it is really starting with education at FIT, Parsons, all of the schools. They've recognized that they need new curriculum. And through our events, our monthly events with the New York Supply Chain Meetup and the Worldwide Supply Chain Federation, we curate content. So we're not all fashion all the time. I don't want to bore my my members to death with my passion. But we had this event with the FIT students and paired them with different local small batch quick turn or new innovations of production to get them to learn what it's like to design with these things and to start with the constraints and to understand what's possible. Oh, you want to do customization? Well, maybe you're using the Suchi grid and you use Suchi X to take an existing pattern that they have and modify it and then choose a different textile and you can change these things and poof, you have a garment that's brought to present within a couple of weeks. They're like, we're not learning anything like this in school. So I think it starts with the students. Because they're the ones that are going to be graduating and saying, you know, why isn't this company using, you know, Bamboo Rose or the enabled 19th Amendment platform, whatever it is, they're thirsty for it. But the schools have yet to really understand what's possible and what the future needs to be, not just what the industry currently thinks it should be, but what it needs to be for us to all still have sustaining life on this planet.
So how long do you think it will take to move the industry in this direction, to really become carbon neutral for the New York area in terms of making clothing?
So we believe realistically within the 4-phase approach that we have to rolling out this new infrastructure, it'll be depending on which brands get on board. Phase one, we're just doing with one brand, 1 year, to doing small batch, quick turn, carbon measured, soup to nuts, to minimize or eliminate dead stock at a handful of stores. That's the vision within year one. So we could put out a press release. Anyone else actually do it? We did the thing. Here's the receipts. And then we're moving into phase two, which is digitization and really creating a platform that you can discover all of these emerging technologies. I've been doing that manually for the past, God, since 2014 or before that, connecting people and founders with enterprise companies and saying, you know, have you talked to each other? You really should know about this cool new technology. Everyone's saying that this is the future, but nobody's actually funding this amazing female founder like Stacy from Evernew. Or there's this new crazy, amazing technology. Savitude is the company. Camilla Olson, I'm actually meeting with her this week in the city. She's created a machine learning and algorithmic design ideation platform where the inputs are images. So you can pull in this sunset for color, this building for structural reference, this car for, you know, design aesthetic or whatever. And those inputs get translated through image recognition, machine learning, and her algorithms to output ideations based on them for patterns and actually can deliver tech packs that you can modify. So the future
That's
of
amazing.
Anyone being able to design anything and have it produced, game changing. She's struggling to have VCs understand what she's producing and the value to the industry. I'm like, this is bananas.
So it sounds like everybody who's actually trying to do something valuable in the fashion technology space has immense difficulty in fundraising.
Yep.
And everybody who has a flash in the pan buzzword idea that they don't actually know how to execute just gets showered with cash.
Yes. Ding, 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 you get it.
But you said it before, it's the lack of understanding from VCs of the business. So yeah. I guess at the same time that you're presenting the solution, it's like you need to have people there that have really lived through what the real issues and challenges are, explaining that.
Yep.
So that they see, you know what I mean? That they can see both.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting because now on the fundraising side for Refashioned, Brian and I, we started with the meetup and realized that we were fast friends. We both were obsessed with supply chains. And basically we met because everyone we knew said, you two won't shut up about supply chain. Go talk to each other about it. So we met for a coffee and we thought it would be a half hour meet and greet. It was like 2 hours of us blah, 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 nonstop about supply chains. And in that first meeting, I told him, you know, I think I'm at the point where I need to go and join somebody else's fund and build out a fashion supply chain vertical. And first time meeting me, he's like, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. I was like, screw you. No, he speaks his mind, but so do I. That's why we get along so well. So I said, well, what do you mean? Easy for you to say you're already a VC at a fund, you know, la-di-da. So he said, no, I've met thousands of people that want to start a fund and they don't hold a candle to your intelligence and expertise, domain knowledge of this space you want to be investing in. If you went to a fund, you already told me most VCs don't know about this space, don't care about it. As soon as they hear fashion, their eyes glaze over, all of the above. And then you layer in supply chain. Is there any innovation?
If they understood the scale of this,
yeah,
it would blow their minds.
Exactly. Well, what I try to communicate to people now is that the internet is nothing compared to the potential for supply chain investment, because the internet was this paltry systems talking to other systems that are networked. But now, with the fourth industrial revolution, everything can talk to everything else. That's much bigger. The whole world is an $88 trillion supply chain. And we would like to be part of the foundation of digitizing that, because the fashion supply chain right now is probably like 1.7 of the $2.3 trillion of this global industry, and that's being paper, you know, carbon, Excel spreadsheets, and slave labor. So once we add every node on this supply chain is being innovated at such a clip that nobody in the industry can keep up with it. And that's when I realized for supply chain, we need a better way to discover and push everything to the industry. And so everything that I've been doing manually, I plan on digitizing.
What's the hardest concept to get across to an investor about any of this? Like, yeah. What are the big stumbling blocks?
Yeah, so I'll share the really silly ones first. Brian and I have literally had an investor say, word on the street is that there's too much team risk because look at the two of you. My co-founder is 6'4", dark as night, black eye from Ghana. And I'm a Puerto Rican woman. So I'm like, wow, you said that out loud?
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
I mean, I had that nonsense when I was raising capital as a female founder, but it was, you know, more expected. That, it just floored me.
So intelligence doesn't come with VCs necessarily, necessarily with the title.
Yeah. I think it's really been, there's no comps for you. Because there aren't any big sequoias that are just built on supply chain like you're planning on doing.
So a comp is, okay, here's Uber, so we're going to fund Lyft because we know it looks like already.
Exactly.
It's comparable to something else. That's the same thing they have done in the movie industry for decades where, oh, it's this plus this with this actor.
The rom-com
okay,
with
we'll fund
swap
it.
Actors.
Yeah. Yeah. They never want to invest in anything new. You have to tell them it's something old for them to invest in it.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. So some of the things I've realized throughout this storied tale of my journey is that you need to really understand who your people are. And don't waste any time with someone that's not just your people. And by that, I mean you can tell in your gut within the first few minutes of chatting with someone, if they get you, and then if they actually want to support you. And those two things alone will change your trajectory on anything. As soon as you stop trying to convince people that will never be your people, your time is freed up to focus on the ones that are. And in doing so, through our community, we are now blessed to have a family office that has been coming to our events for 2 years. And they came up to us at last year's two-day summit and said, you know, been coming to your events. You guys are clearly onto something. I would love to help you start cutting some checks via SPVs, special purpose vehicles. It's basically setting up a micro LLC for each investment so that Refashioned can have credit for actually doing a deal and sit on a cap table, but it's somebody else's money and we're responsible for managing the deal and doing all the diligence with them. So for family offices, they generally don't invest directly in startups. They like to invest in other funds or later stage growth stage companies. This fund said, you know, we believe in you and we love your community. You know your stuff. We'd love to help you get a track record and benefit from your awesome deal flow. So we've started with that.
For people who don't know, what is a family office?
Oh, yeah. A family, there's different types.
I just thought it was a friendly office.
Yeah. I wish.
My dentist, his wife works there.
Yeah. Your kids are welcome. Yeah.
And they're funding everything. Dentists so have nice. A lot of money.
Yeah. I wish. So family offices are really private wealth. A family generally that has accrued a high net worth and they want to deploy their capital into other investment vehicles to sustain and increase their wealth. So there's a lot of family offices. Unlike venture capital, when you're a founder raising money from VCs, you can like search on the internet. There is no search for family offices. They don't want to be found because they're really, really rich and they don't want people knocking on their door. So it makes it really extra fun to raise a fund. The other option is LPs, limited partners that are either institutional, like CalPERS or the Princeton Endowment, et cetera, and other limited partners that will cut checks, usually larger checks, $5 to $10 million. So if you're a first-time fund, which I am, my co-founder is not, but I negate all of his expertise apparently because I haven't cut checks into deals, it makes it all that much harder. So we're fortunate enough through our community, like I said, the world's conspiring to help us get where we need to go, have this family office that's helping us to start to get a track record so we can show everyone, yeah, there's no comps, but look at the amazing deals we've gotten into. And when I first started getting Brian on board and excited about this space, I was just talking about fashion supply chain. And I said, well, the world is a supply chain, and that means everything is connected to everything else. There's this magical convergence that's happening. Your supply chain is part of your consumer-facing experience. So really, our fund should be everything. We invest across four different areas right now: data, logistics, advanced materials, and advanced manufacturing. And if you think about it, the fashion supply chain touches every other industry in the world. So I'm like, what better place for me to be focused on? So we really have this global presence now through our community. We have the ability to start cutting checks through SPVs with this family office that believes in us. And we've been talking to some great institutional LPs that are getting lined up. We're getting our ducks in a row to have some potential amazing long-term partners that will give us the clout that we need to deploy the type of capital that's really needed in this space.
So have you spent an enormous amount of time working with manufacturers here already?
Yes.
And what does that look like in terms of cooperation, or what becomes their challenges to be able to work with you?
Sure. I think the biggest thing, again, is to communicate that we are not trying to become their business. We don't want to come in and build a factory. That's not our goal. We don't want to change how they do business. We want to understand what their constraints are so that we can start with them and match them to someone that can work with their constraints. Because there's plenty of factories here. In presenting all of my data to this big brand, looked up that the textile and fashion industry in the United States in 2018 was $77 billion. I'm like, why is everyone saying there's none of that here? There's plenty. You look at Maker's Row, you look at all these other platforms now, they're here. They just don't want to be squished by a huge brand coming in and telling them, you have to do it this way or we can't work with you. So my role, I see, is to be that conduit, the catalyst to really manage the expectations and realities and needs on both sides of the equation. The buyers and builders, you need each other. You just need to learn to speak the same language and not try to kill each other, you know, in the process. Because big brands can certainly come in and destroy a factory. You know, oh, you have to do 120-day term on your invoices. No. If they're a small factory, there's no way they can sustain that.
Can this also bring down costs on both sides? Yes.
Yes. So that's the beautiful thing. If imagine we're all producing using some recycled garment, textile, circular regenerated textile. So you have multiple brands that are all using the same factory network and are all using that same mill and pulping and recycling. All your price points come down because you're all investing in the same raw materials, the same needs for production. We start there, and then you could layer on your technologies. The things that everyone is really kind of starting with right now, the, ooh, we're going to have a digitally knitted sweater in store that somebody designed and tried on with augmented reality. That's great, but it really doesn't move the needle unless you have this infrastructure to layer it on top of.
That's a sideshow.
Yeah, exactly. Shiny objects.
So you talk about localization, and then you made a couple of references to small batch. What mm-hmm. is small batch to you?
Yeah. So small batch could be 25 to 250 of an item.
Okay.
And
you feel there are a lot of people that are doing small batch here now.
Yes.
That are not charging like
so
$85 to make that small batch of 25 pieces.
So
I mean, are there?
Not 85, but, you know, maybe closer to 10. And so it's not a matter of today, the price points are going to be comparable to overseas. But another part of the equation that nobody's really talking about is kind of, let's just sweep it under the rug, is your landed cost of goods sold versus the cost of your globalized supply chain. So it doesn't matter what your landed cost of goods sold is. If you have a, you know, hundreds of millions of dollar cost overhead in managing your globalized supply chain, how many human bodies are you flying all over the world for inspections and QA and all the nonsense that happens with your globalized supply chain?
And duty and
yes,
everything else. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. So we are, in essence, by creating this traceable, trackable, fully auditable, transparent, localized supply chain, saying, let's compare apples to apples. You know, because your landed cost of goods sold is not the whole story.
They need to open their eyes to that again,
yep.
I guess. You know, and you're starting with a particular set of raw materials.
Yep.
And, you know, expanding it will take time, right? Because
yes.
you're also costs a lot of money to bring other raw materials here as opposed to making it overseas
yeah.
and paying the duty on the finished garment.
There's also, you know, a lot of lab-grown textiles and new materials that are, you know, all the bio, you know, mushrooms and pineapple and banana leaf. And I saw cactus leather, you know, out of Mexico. There's all this stuff. We have that stuff.
True. And it's fascinating
you know?
And it's not really there yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so for us to want to get there, and make it scalable and adoptable by an entire industry instead of single vertically integrated digital native brands, which are great. They're just not going to move the needle as fast as we need on the scale we need. For us to get there, we need to invest in this infrastructure first. And I was frankly shocked that all these companies around the world, like Li and Fung, was saying, yeah, nobody else is working on this the way you've configured it. I was like, that can't be. I'm not that smart.
Nobody wants to be working
yeah,
on it.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Well, it seems like so many of these big fashion companies are still running with 90s playbook. They say they're not.
Yep.
But every time they turn around, they go back to it.
Yeah.
So, what does the Worldwide Supply Chain Federation nonprofit do?
Yeah, so it's not a nonprofit.
Oh, it's not?
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
So you're the co-founder of two different companies.
Yes.
Okay.
We haven't been charging for events because we wanted to optimize for the free exchange of great ideas. And cost can be a barrier for an emerging company. And we've had lots of emerging companies that, frankly, have gotten their access to the right people just by showing up to our events to speak or to be in the audience. So that organization started just in New York. And like I said, after the first event, we had people reaching out to us from around the world and asking, can we have an event like this in Bangalore, in Sydney, in Berlin? I was like, whoa, we just had one event and we haven't been charging for it. So all of this has been out of our relationships with big enterprise companies, getting free space, getting for them to pay for the cold pizza and warm water that we serve our guests. And it's just grown organically. In New York alone, we have over, I want to say, 2,100 members. And we launched a chapter in Charleston, South Carolina in our second year. We have, so they have regular monthly events as well. We had an event in Bangalore in our first year. We had an event with AB InBev MIT in Bogota, Colombia last year. And last year was also our first two-day global supply chain summit at Microsoft. We had 800 people fly in from all over the world. And I believe it was 12 different countries, startups flew in from all around the world on their dime to have access to the people that we bring into the room. because it's a curated network of C-suite executives, executive management, you know, of your Fortune 100s and the best of emerging startups. And our intention with these events is not to have someone sit on the stage and talk about the great thing they built and how it was seamless and had so much ROI. And that's most events are like that. We wanted to really pull back the cover and say, let's have a real dialogue about like blockchain. You know, some of those events end up being the most feisty because our community lives in this stuff and they're frustrated because their companies aren't adopting new technologies. So you get the employees and the emerging technologists and the C-suite that are all in the same room having this meaningful dialogue about like, well, it's not possible. Well, this company did it, and they're just going to present to you how they did it with this huge company. So it's the real conversations that need to happen to move these innovations forward and to get adoption and investment and pilots.
Is the New York Supply Chain Meetup still going on?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We have an event February 20th at Microsoft, and the topic is circular supply chains.
How often do you have the meetings?
So it's January through June. We take off for the summer, primarily because we get donated spaces. And after hours, they charge like $1,000 an hour to keep on the AC. We're like, we have 200 people usually crammed into the room. It gets really hot. No go. So we take the summer off and then kick up again in October or September, October, November, take off in December, and we curate the next year of schedule, what types of events we're going to have, the cadence of content, and start to plan out the types of companies that we need to reach out to have as presenters.
And should people in the fashion business go to these meetups?
Oh my God, yes.
Okay.
It's interesting. From our summit last year, we had this amazing woman from GBG. She's, I forget her exact title, Lauren Lisak, she told me I could use her quote, and I put it on the website because it was something like, you know, this was by far the most intelligent, meaningful conversation I've had around the future of my industry. And it wasn't just talking about fashion. It was everything from your shipping and trucking, last mile, the legal of globalized supply chains becoming digitized, having your content transfer across imaginary data lines and having to switch into new compliance standards. You know, all of this stuff is the type of things that we like to bring to our community.
Lisa, this has been a wonderful conversation. I hope we can continue having this conversation because you're definitely doing something that will change everything.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming and talking to us.
Commendable. It's really amazing.
Thank you. It's my calling. And so it doesn't feel like work. It feels like it's an inevitability. And I've had quite a few people over the years since the Fashion Tech Lab say, what are you up to? Don't worry, you'll eventually find something. And I'm like, don't worry about me. I know the path I'm on. I just need to, you know, congeal it so that everyone else can see what I've been working towards.
Thank you for listening to American Fashion Podcast. On our website, AmericanFashionPodcast.com, you can find our Be a Guest form, as well as a sign-up page for invitations to our live shows, and a new feature, the Archives, with roughly 250 episodes published. The old shows don't fit in our feed anymore, so we've made them available for a nominal fee. Please continue the conversation online. On Twitter, we are at AFPOD, and on Instagram, we are at American Fashion Show. And I personally am at Fashion Tech Guru on just about everything. For direct comments, give us a call at 646-979-8709. That's our voicemail line. Or email info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Mouth Media Network, which holds the copyright to this and all other episodes, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends. Keep making things beautiful. Remain in force. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.
This is Mouth Media Network, audio for business.